consistency structure simulator. For a while, the Hewlett Packard Company was backing that particular program. It's a $50,000 program before you add all the goodies you can add to it. Extremely well-respected program among the microwave enthusiasts. Well, that particular program does not recognize our latest breakthrough antenna. So I'm an empirical type person. I like, you know, real physical experiments. And that way you can get your feet on the ground, down to the bedrock sometimes, a little bit more traceable to the Bureau. And so I'm a little skeptical of some of the modeling programs currently available. NECT that Bob is using is an extremely well-respected program, but know that occasionally it can lie to you. And I think Bob may have discovered one of the ways that it can lie to you. Now, I'm probably putting quite a few words in your mouth there, Bob. And so please tell us what you've discovered. And you've done a real interesting set of experiments. And as you do the post-mortem of this whole situation, I think there's a number of lessons to be learned here and new discoveries to be made. W2OSR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, W2OSR, let me remove your foot from my mouth. It wasn't automatically done to optimize the antenna. This was all done manually with the next three programs. I changed spacings, I changed, wire length and things like that to get them to work and optimize it to get what I wanted out of it. As we were talking, now I'm looking at the document here with the antenna pattern showing the 45.2 degree beam width at minus 3 dB, the forward gain of 24.75, and this is 20 feet over ground, I might add. What the heck was the front to back ratio? The front to back ratio of 36.99 dB. Now, we all believe that EasyNet is fibbing to us here tonight, over.
It reminds me a little bit of a particular antenna. I think it was called the Loop. No, it was called the Log Periodic Yagi. There was a manufacturer who manufactured an antenna that was used on 432 megacycles called the Log Periodic Yagi. And this appeared in some of the earlier issues of Ham Radio Magazine. The philosophy there was you take a typical Yagi, which has got nice gain and beam width and whatever, front to back ratio, but it's rather limited in bandwidth. So if you make the driven element assembly, like the gun of a cathode ray tube, you make the gun assembly out of log periodic, which is known to be octaves wide in many cases, multiple octaves wide, you get the best of both worlds. Good sounding theory. The manufacturer claimed 24 dB of gain over a dipole on this antenna, which had something like 20 elements, as I remember. And when the real antenna from that manufacturer on a couple of occasions appeared at antenna gain competitions, I think the gain measured something like 12. They claimed 24 and measured something like 12. And we're talking about decibels over dipole or decibels over isotropic. Almost doesn't matter. Huge differences between the claim and the reality. The East Coast VHF Society, starting in roughly 1969, year after year, would hold these competitions at Trenton State College and also Saddlebrook Park in New Jersey. Let me drop. And it was a friendly competition among the VHF, UHF operators of that day. Guys were homebrewing antennas. They wanted to find out whose antenna worked the best. And they also were slowly becoming very suspicious of antenna manufacturers fibbing pretty strongly on the claim of gain in their advertisements. So the competition was a friendly competition among hams. The guys in Pennsylvania and New Jersey and Massachusetts and Connecticut and Maryland would all get together at these sites in New Jersey, and for a day they would go and measure their antennas in the middle of a field. Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU from Bell Laboratories, would help them set up this antenna range, and they made measurements that to some degree were traceable to the Bureau. A good outdoor reflective ground plane antenna range was set up with about a 300-foot range on that antenna on a nice flat grassy field on the Trenton State College, among other places. And so I guess these antenna competitions went on for approximately 15 years, and I think you could say during every one of those 15 years, the winning antenna was a homebrew antenna by a radio amateur. None of the commercial antennas ever won that competition. And in many cases, the commercial antennas really didn't do a good showing for themselves when somebody really went in the field and measured their gains. it was rapidly discovered that what was going on was that in many cases the antenna gain was being set in the advertising department, not in the measurement laboratory at the antenna company. The net result of all of that is that for the last zillion years, QST Magazine will not allow you as a antenna manufacturer who is putting an ad in their magazine to make a decimal claim for the gain of the antenna. It may allow you to talk about the beamwidth, but you can't talk about the gain because the numbers have always been so crazy. So they just eliminated that as a spectrum altogether. The manufacturers soon realized what was going on. Let me drop. I'll get over to Alex in a minute. And that is a brand new amateur comes into the hobby, and at first he is overwhelmed by the fact that there's a large number of transmitters he can buy, a large number of antennas he can buy. Well, when it comes to the antenna, he says, I got this number of dollars to spend, and this manufacturer claims 15 dB, this one claims 14.5, this one claims 16. If I can afford it, I'm going to buy the 16. Well, the 16 may be a fifth, so you can see what's going on here. Alex, go ahead with your comment.
Just a short comment. To get the real, quote-unquote, real gain of an antenna, you multiply the number of elements by 0.75, and you're getting the best approximation that you can get. Back to you, Dick.
That's a ballpark figure, Alex, as a beginning. It turns out that Dr. Gunter Hawk, DL6W, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform, Dr. Gunter Hawk, has spent most of a lifetime studying the state-of-the-art of Yagis. By the way, I'm getting a thunderstorm here. If I suddenly go off the air, you guys know why. And he has come up with a more complicated formula, which does an extremely good job of predicting the best antenna. And he does it primarily as a function of boom length. Once you know the number of wavelengths of the boom of the Yagi antenna, he can predict for you within a couple of tenths of a dB of what gain is possible. And you study the real 25 different designs that he's got, that he's studied over the years, maybe a bigger number than that. It fits the formula very well. A rough rule of thumb is you get almost 3 decibels of improvement in gain of a Yagi antenna every time you double the length of the boom, assuming that everything is well-tuned. It's roughly 3 dB per octave type stuff. And everyone thinks that when you make the Yagi longer and longer and the gain is getting higher and higher, that the beamwidth is getting more and more narrow, gain bandwidth product type stuff. Not necessarily. It's not an operational amplifier where the gain bandwidth philosophy works. There are designs of Yagis that are very long that are reasonably broad by comparison of the shorter Yagis. So it's not a simple situation. And it's a zillion different antenna designs for Yagi. A lot of people think that, I've got this amount of space available on my tower. Who's got the best design? That makes the assumption that there's only one particular Yagi design. And there isn't. There's lots of them. They may look very similar when you get down to the specifics of exactly how long is each element and what is the spacing. You'll find that there are very subtle differences. So let me turn it back to Bob. Bob, what's your guess as to what happened? And maybe you don't know yet, and I can understand that. What do you intend to do next? You've got a very interesting story. There's a lot of lessons to be learned. I'd like to be, I hope you'll keep this particular group informed as you dig into what happened here. My guess is your computer is not lying. In other words, every time you ask it to multiply these two numbers together, it's always going to come up with exactly the right answer.
Repeater, timeout.
And NEC 3.0 is a very respected program. So, is there a possibility that a glitch occurred in the way that program was transferred to your particular computer? That's a guess. I can't believe your computer is lying. You could reinstall that program on another computer, and I think there's a high probability you get the exact same answer. And by the way, when it comes to these fractal diagrams, that isn't necessarily so. There are people who will take a fractal program and go from computer A to computer B and get a slightly different answer. That's not an easy one to explain. So over to you, Bob, as to what you intend to do next, and please keep us informed as you do this investigation. And when you really build the antenna and measure it, that should be another interesting set of experiments. W2OSR, K2RIW.
Okay, W2OSR. Now, remember you were talking about the laggy, as I would call it, log periodic, gaggy antenna. Remember that thing that was at the top of my car a couple of ham fests ago that you took a quick look at and then realized what it was? The KLM version of the antenna we were just talking about. At any rate, I've got somebody that has a more advanced version of Kinect, and you get Kinect 7, which makes mega bucks for it. So I'll have it remodeled and see what that program says. I may also build one of these out of the what was left over from that big monster 20-foot boom antenna that I brought to the ham fest. We'll see how it actually plays. I'm guessing that it's going to have about 11 CPU gain. What happens with it. Anyway, back to you, Dick.
Bob, when you first checked in, you had nice, loud audio. Every other transmission since then, your audio is, 7 or 8 dB weaker. I presume you're talking in the front of the mic and you're standing the normal distance. I'm wondering why your audio has dropped back so much. Over to you, Bob.
Okay, how's this? A little bit better?
A whole lot better. What changed, Bob?
I wasn't holding the mic directly in front of my mouth.
Okay. When you get a chance and have Andy look at that particular rig, I'm not convinced that you're filling out the audio that you could. You got a nice voice, and I think we ought to hear all of it. I think you're a tiny bit low in deviation setting. Okay, that next 7.0 should be interesting to see what it says about that particular Yagi design that you manually optimized. You didn't have the program automatically optimizing it. Very good. Before I go over to a new subject, which I've got in front of me, did I skip anyone who checked in who had a question or a comment? Please give us your call letters and name right now. K2RYW.
WHYY.
Joe recognized. Anyone else? We're leaving nice long delays tonight. I'm a little bit amazed that we're not getting somebody from internet checking in. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, going back, there was a gentleman that checked in from the Massapequa area that said he couldn't get Channel 2 digital from New York. And I thought this was a little funny because he's about 20 miles or so close to the city that I am. I was able to actually get Channel 2 digital in his particular area where my mobile set up. You probably find that very hard to believe, but I actually could decode 4 of the 5 or 6 channels in New York City quite viewable as I moved around the parking lot by a rather large store, the Massapequa mall area. So that proves the signal available in the area. You had asked me about something about the antenna I'm using, how many elements, how much gain it had, and so forth. I guess you wanted me to come back with this information at the time, and I didn't have it available. I do have it now. Would you like it?
I sure would. We've done some very successful experiments of digital television reception in Sable, and what brand name and what model number and what's the claim in performance of the particular antenna you're using. Take your time, and you got it, Joe.
Okay, this is a house installation. This is not what I use the mobile. What I use the mobile, you wouldn't believe me if I told you, but it's actually a quarter-wave VHF round Magman antenna on the vehicle, a couple of them, one for receiving and one for using a monitor receiver for comparative results, and that actually received pretty good up on the 7800 megahertz band, I thought it would be. The antenna I'm using is a WireGuard HD7698P. It's a deep fringe model antenna. It has a boom length of 168.25 inches. Active elements, it has 64 active elements, 35 on UHF and 29 on VHF. VHF gain on channel 7 is 10.4D, that's over a dipole. 12.0D on channel 13, UHF is rated for 14.2D on channel 14, and 13.0D on channel 69. I also use with this is a preamplifier that's mass mounted, which is an AP8275. That has a gain of 29 dB on VHF, 28 dB on UHF, noise figure on VHF 2.9 dB, noise figure on VHF 2.9, noise figure on VHF, VHF 2.9, UHF 2.8. You would also ask me if I could receive in my house without the preamp. Now, that wasn't an easy thing to really go up there and do, but I actually did do it. Let's see. Channel 2, no. Channel 4, no. Channel 5, yes. channel 21, yes, channel 25, yes, and channel 41, yes. All the other channels I could not receive from New York without the preamp. When I put the preamp in, I got channels 2, 4, 5, 7, 9, 11, 21, 25, 31, 41, 47, and 68 out of New York.
And you're talking about the digital versions of those now. If I talked about channel 2 analog, 54 to 60 megacycles, I'm sure you continue to receive that without the preamp. But the digital equivalent of channel 2 is what you're talking about that disappeared when you took out the preamp. So just on that one channel as a for instance, did I hear you correctly on that one, Joe? Go ahead.
All the channels I'm talking about are all UHF television broadcast channels in digital format. The antenna model I have only covers channel 7 to 13 as far as the element dimensions, and UHF 14 through 69 does not cover channels 2 through 6.
Very good. And 168.25 inches of boom length. That's 14.02 feet. 14-foot boom on a on a television receiving aerial. From your point of view, Joe, is that antenna considered deep fringe reception type antenna? And you went flat out and got that particular Weingott model number. I think you called the model number the HD769-something. You have to run that number by me one more time. You gave it to me a little bit fast. So is that considered a deep fringe antenna, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes, it is called an HD769-8P. Yes, it is considered a deep fringe model, probably for ranges up to, I think they say, 60 or 65 miles, something like that. But just like thinking, just like you, there's no sense in having an antenna with too little gain. I'd rather have one that has more gain than I need. It gives me a good margin for safety, as far, well, not safety, but when it rains or you know you have bad signal conditions coming in. And being that's only about 30 to 35 feet above the ground, I need all the gain I can get.
I'm doing a quick calculation here right now. Did I do that right? No. Wow. Did I goof that one up? 35 exponential 3. Good. 20 divide, square root. Alrighty. In one of those channels, I think it was channel 7, your antenna supposedly has 13 dB of gain, and that would mean that it must have less than 41.8 degrees of beamwidth. Did WineGuide give you any kind of pattern information or beamwidth pattern information on any of the frequencies where the gain was rated, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes, they did. I believe I sent all this stuff to you by email. There was like a comparison chart for looking at all the different models, and I think the comparison chart also gave you possible polar shots of these things, horizontal polar shots of what the beamwidth was.
Okay, what I've done in the past is to realize that many of these antenna manufacturers are fairly proud of the pattern they were able to tune, and they would give you those patterns, and they would also have gain claims. And once you realize that the laws of physics dictate that a gain of X dB means that the horizontal and vertical beamwidth can't be above this number, which I'll call Y. That's a necessary but not sufficient. In other words, you've got to have at least that narrowness of beamwidth, otherwise you can't possibly have that gain. That's just physics. And quite often these antenna manufacturers, when you compare one set of data against the other, you realize it doesn't correlate. You know that an error has occurred somewhere, intentional or unintentional. So sometimes these guys are exceeding the laws of physics a little bit. I guarantee it's a good antenna. This might not be quite as good as they claim, but I'm going to review that data, which I think you mailed to me about a month ago. And in fact, give me a rough guess so I know how far back in my records to look when you mailed that file to me, Joe. Go ahead.
Possibly as long as maybe 2 months ago, because I bought the antenna actually I think the end of going into November, into December, and I might have mailed it to you something like maybe the end of December, so it's maybe going back 2.5 months, possibly back that far. If you don't have it, I'll resend it again.
Now, there's a particular place where I put all the stuff I get from you. All I got to do is look there, and I'll find it. Okay, and I thank you. So that's fascinating that without the preamp, you've got a reasonable quality of transmission line, and it's not a zillion feet long, you really need the line driving preamp in order to get many of those channels. Good to know. And I think that was into APG, Dave, who was telling us in Massapequa that he wasn't getting certain channels. I think that was Dave a week or two ago. And so I've been out over Dave's house. He doesn't live on top of the mountain, but he lives in reasonably flat land. He should have had rather good coverage to Manhattan, and we'll eventually get to the bottom of that. When we finally do flip over to digital television in earnest in June, there's going to be quite a few discussions of what channels people do and don't get now versus then. We'll hear about that. I made a discovery to me this week, which is kind of fascinating. Mel and I have for some time been talking about the virtues of a purely vertical dipole, and that it's an antenna that's extremely unrepresented in the literature and what amateurs are using. Everybody sets up a horizontal dipole because they think vertical is too difficult, particularly bringing off the transmission line from the center of the dipole up in the middle of the air. Geometrically logistically, it looks like a difficult problem. And I've been saying that there's nothing magic about feeding the dipole in the center. You can definitely feed it from one end. An end-fed ZEP antenna is that. ZEP, by the way, comes from the fact that the antenna was first developed for Zeppelins, blimps in the early days of radio. A ZEP antenna is a very respected antenna, and it is fed from one end. It is essentially a halfway dipole fed from one end. Let me drop. Okay, a buddy I work with is doing an experiment in which he needs a portable high-gain antenna. And he found an antenna in an article that we all have seen quite often, and it's called the DXZone.com website. If you go to www.dxzone.com/catalog/antennas, you'll see a whole bunch of articles written by ham radio operators. Quite a few of them are European, of very respected antenna designs. And if you go to that site and you go to the so-called 6-meter antenna called Delta Loops 450 megahertz, there's an article there called Delta Loop 450 megahertz under the heading of TXZone.com. And you'll see a nice design of a Delta Loop antenna. At the end of that design, which is not even shown in the title, is something called a vertical. The vertical antenna is a halfway vertical. The particular design happens to be 450 megacycles. But remember, I've been telling you guys that when you feed one end of a half-wave dipole, where you did not put an egg insulator in the center, you just start off with one simple piece of wire a half wavelength long, mounted vertical, if you've got enough real estate to do that, it's got the right kind of support structures, and feed it from the bottom. And I said the impedance would be around 2,000 ohms. Well, I did a little more checking on that. Under real circumstances, it's closer to 1,000 ohms. This particular design, called the vertical antenna, and the design is 450 megacycles, has at the bottom, not what I've been talking about, a loading coil like you've got on the inside of your mag mount, your 5/8 wave mag mount. That's the logical way to get 1,000 ohms, a step-up transformer, so to speak. I never even considered how easy it is to do with a stub in coaxial cable. And that's what this design is. And it's a stub design, and when you study the length of those stubs, and it's very easy to build on any band from 80 meters all the way up to at least 2 meters, if not 432. Very simple piece of coax, because if you and I did a real launching structure built with a step-up transformer, let me drop. The first thing we'd have to worry about is how do you weatherproof it, how do you assemble it, how do you tune it. There's a whole lot of rigmarole involved. How do you ground it? What do you use for a counterpoise? This guy has worked it all out with a very simple coaxial stub structure. Very easy to reproduce. And I took his exact dimensions. I went to the Velakis or any of the other versions of the Velakis is the fourth edition. Jassic and Johnson are the second and third editions. Johnson, I guess, is the third edition. Jassic and Johnson, the second edition. We're all talking about the Antenna Engineering Handbook, Chapter 4, figure 4-3 and 4-4. What's unique about figure 4-3 and 4-4, which to the antenna people are called the Brown and Woodward curves. These guys, Brown and Woodward, spent a couple of years of their life, in my opinion, way back in 1946, building what you and I would think is every possible dipole. They really built monopoles. They started off with a great big piece of ground plane material, and they took various diameters of monopoles and carefully measured the exact impedance, the resistive component and the reactive component. So any antenna you're about to build of a monopole or dipole-like structure, and your first question is, what's the impedance going to be? You go to that curve, and the answer is there. All worked out for you with probably 98% accuracy, so to speak. This is real empirical data. Not in the days when everybody had to do this with a slotted line and a single generator. They put a lot of effort into this. You and I could run off these curves in 2 days with a good modern-day network analyzer. These guys spent a year doing it, if you ask me. So it's all there. You take this 6-meter vertical antenna that's under the heading of the 6-meter delta loop that's in that DX zone website, and you plug in the numbers for the length of wire for the antenna, and sure enough, it comes out to be 1,100 ohms impedance, resistive component, and minus 200 ohms reactive component, 200 ohms capacitive. And you look at these stubs that this guy has told you to tune, one stub 0.034 wavelength long and another stub 0.216 wavelength long, and you put them together with a simple D connector, like he said. The coax cable is automatically weatherproof. You only got one little opening at the end where you connect the wire of the antenna itself. And you're feeding this dipole from the bottom with this the T connector and this coaxial stub. Very simple structure. One tiny little place to weatherproof. And you study what it does with the formulas we know about, and you realize repeater timeout. And you realize you get about a 1.1 standing wave ratio. Beautiful design. So it doesn't have to be that vertical antennas are not being properly represented. We now know of a way of easily reproducing one. I happen to have a structure that will support a thing like this, and if I get some time in the next couple of months, I want to go and build one. So, Mel, when you study this particular design, you may find that it's a little bit easier to feed than what you did. I think you're feeding your green wire vertical dipole that's in front of your house. I believe you're feeding it from the center in the more conventional manner. And if you wanted to experiment with feeding it from the bottom with this stub technique that I just told you about, boy, that looks like a nice, easy way to go. And maybe you want to put up a second one and use them as a phased array. Since that neighbor of yours is so helpful, you could put a second one on the neighbor's property, phase it against the one on your property, and get 3 or 4 dB of extra gain in one particular direction. Or you can electronically tune which direction depending on which one you feed early and which one you feed late. You could be electronically adjusting the beam on 80 or 40 meters with vertically polarized antennas. That would be something to talk about. So, Mel, over to you for comments on that and or what kind of mail you've been getting this week. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. What I did with the 40-meter vertical, 65 feet tall, of course, originally that started out as part of my, used to use it basically on 80 meters and set it just basically, of course, against all that ground wire. I laid down those radials that are buried. However, I am using that antenna now as a 40-meter antenna, and it is not fed in the center. It's fed down on the bottom. In fact, I have a coil in the bottom, and the reason I did that is this way, it actually has, the coil has got a ground, one end of the coil is grounded, and the other is then it's tapped. To load properly on 40 meters. The reason I did that, I wanted it to have definitely a DC, a direct reference, you know, a direct connection to a ground rod stick, so that for what we just had here, all this lightning. By the way, we had not only lightning, we had hail. Boy, you want to see this ice coming down. The whole driveway was full of ice, Dick. But I wanted that end, this vertical, to be, in other words, connected to a ground rod at all times, over.
Okay. This stub-fed technique that I'm talking about is perfectly grounded. The vertical halfway length piece of wire connects to the semiconductor of the upper piece of coax, the one that's approximately a quarter wavelength long. That in turn goes to a T connector. The common lead of the T goes to the transmitter. The other used length of the T has the short stub that is a pure short circuit on the semiconductor. So the antenna and the coax cable, DC-wise, is completely grounded. So this particular vertical stub-fed thing that I'm telling you about fulfills your requirement of a good lightning arresting at the same time as a beautiful impedance match and feeding it from the bottom. So it's not easy to find because, when you go to dxzone.com, you would never think you're going to find a beautiful vertical antenna design under the heading of Delta Loop 450 megahertz. But the second half of that article has this beautiful design. As I said, I ran upon it by accident because a buddy of mine is building one of these antennas. And I decided to look at the other antennas on the site and ran into this thing. And I said, gee, that is a beauty. It turns out that this particular design was developed by a respected antenna designer a whole lot of years ago. It just hasn't been very well advertised, so to speak. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2IYW.
I think I did a modeling. I think part of it, funny, I think we did the Smith chart. I think we did something on stub matching a vertical antenna, if I'm not mistaken. I gave a hypothetical case where I came up with this, but I think something rings a bell there. I have to look back in the old notes from like a year and a half ago. Now, the radiating element, let's say, on 40 meters that you're looking at, unfortunately, there aren't that many supports around here, so I'd have a problem finding a 65-foot support anywhere else around except for that one tall tree that I have in the front. But the radiating element, I assume, is a full 65 feet tall in this this method of this vertical also. Am I correct, over?
Absolutely. The actual wire portion of the antenna, not counting the impedance matching stubs, is 0.494 wavelength long. It's on close to a half wave. So it's just going to be within a foot or so of 65 feet long at 40 meters, Mel. Go ahead. And by the way, if you don't have any more supports, obviously it's time you plant some more trees. Over to you. A tree grows in Brooklyn. Sounds like a book.
Roger. Stock planting. Spruce trees around, and well, if you can guarantee we'll be around to see it get to about 65 feet, I'd be more than glad to do it. This is basically what I'm doing, Dick. You almost described it exactly, except what I did. I did put a coil in the bottom, but now that you mention it, of course, put a T in there and put a stub in, and I'm sure it would work quite well. The point is, I'm only using it on 40 meter CW. I never liked 40 meter phones. It's always been plagued with those broadcasters, the foreign broadcasters, so I've never really gotten into 40 meter single sideband. I stay down on the low end of 40 meters, down and usually in a CW portion, around within the first 50 kilohertz of 7.0 usually in that area. So the antenna seems to work quite well in that area. That's where I more or less laid out the design for. And I could say I'm 40 meters. So far, I can honestly say everything I hear, I have worked. And I have no complaints with that antenna, really, Dick, which causes some more controversy I'll get through later, over.
Yeah, since you like the 40-meter band so well, and now that our sunspot cycle is not very desirable, except for the foreign broadcasters, 40 meters is an excellent band. Didn't I hear recently that the broadcasters, either in the last month or so or in the month that's coming, are all going to be turning off their transmitters in the 40-meter band, the foreign broadcasters? Isn't the 40-meter band, by the WARC agreement, about to become exclusively amateur? Am I wrong on that one? I thought I read that somewhere very recently. Over to you, Mel.
number of them are going to conform with that shifting off the 40-meter band in the amateur radio portion of the band, but not all. I understand that there are a number of countries, especially in Africa, that will continue using that on the 40-meter band. What the effect will be, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see which ones are going and see what happens after that. So I just hope that these other ones that are staying there, these African ones, that some more of them don't come on figuring, oh boy, look at this, nice open territory, and get the idea why not take up what was vacated. Because, you know, they don't actually belong to, I guess they have representatives that come to the Geneva, you know, court there where they, the IARU and all, I don't know if they subscribe to everything that, you know, that is decided there, take over.
Okay, this really good antenna design, though, you could almost say it's not one stub, it's two stubs. And let me give you a quick description. The transmission line, 50-ohm transmission line from the transmitter, goes out to the common lead of a T-connector. On the left-hand side of the T-connector is a shorted stub, which on 40 meters is going to be about 2.5 feet long. That's easy. That's the one that's providing the short for the center conductor for lightning protection, as well as a beautiful impedance match. The right-hand side of the stub is another piece of 50-ohm coax that on 40 meters is going to be around 18 or so feet long, 18.5 feet long. And the end of that, the end away from the T-connector, is where the shield suddenly stops. You do some weatherproofing. The center conductor picks up the radiating wire, which is now going to be the 65-foot approximately length piece of wire. So it's an interesting arrangement. It's almost two stubs. It's two pieces of carefully chosen coax on a T-connector that makes all this magic happen. But that at the tuned frequency will give you something like a 1.1 standing wave ratio. Very nice design when you study the charts, so to speak. And this is a little bit different than the Smith chart study you give to the stub tuner. You use something a little bit simpler than that to demonstrate the principle. And that's a very popular technique. When you put a coaxial stub, shorted or open, at right angle to a T-connector on a piece of transmission line, what you're really doing, let me drop, is you are with that coaxial cable at your operating frequency, synthesizing an extremely high performance inductor or capacitor of some exact value that you have chosen. That's what the stub can do. And because it's made out of a shorted or open piece of coax, it's very easy to weatherproof, very easy to mechanically protect it. It's very rugged. And if you try to, with a real inductor or a real capacitor, get that same performance, it would be difficult without making a fairly voluminous component. So we amateurs have made very little use of stubs. Properly used, they can perform an awful lot of magic. I'll turn it back to you for comments on all of the above. I guess from what you're saying, Mel, your neighbors don't have a tall pine tree in front of their house like you do. So making this phased array is not going to be quite as easy as it sounds. But you have other support structures on the property which could be used for a function like this, as I see it. And what kind of mail have you been getting this week? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, I'm getting some cross-eyed looks here because if I put any more wire or any more antennas, I'm going to be, as they say, living out in the doghouse, or in my case, having a doghouse, but I have a garage. the situation is that, you know, there's already, even with the camouflaging, I try to keep it, as they say, low-key. You know, I just make sure that I can't make a mess in the garden. It's really got to be stuff that's really not in any way going to interfere with flowers and grass and things like that. So I'm just about, I think, sort of at my limit lately with what I have now. You know, I've got an antenna literally for everything now, covering 160 through right up through VHF, UHF and everything. I mean, so that's a... gets it about the end of the line, Dick, and that's it. As far as, I got a number of questions. First, I'll answer it. I got this question here. Let me let it drop. First of all, do you want to pick up Paul? Is Paul with us? Do you want to take the space report or anything else before we get started here? Over.
Excellent suggestion. Paul did sign in. I think he said he doesn't have a question, but the space shuttle landed a couple of days ago, and I think it had been delayed at least one orbit because of weather or wind, whatever. So, Paul, if you're available, tell us what NASA has been doing that we'd like to know about. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. Maybe he got called away, or maybe we led him to believe that we're not going to be putting in a space for the space report tonight. Oh, well. If you're listening to us, Paul, and you come back, break in any time. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, this is A2KEY. All right. Well, Howie N2GOT checked in a little while ago for the mobile, and he posed a question to me, a very interesting question the other day, which I'm not sure I could really have given him an answer, but maybe he did get some answers today because he did go to Timonian Hamfest and get together there in Maryland. That's where they were coming back from. They had left Friday, and I hope the Hamfest went off because the weather was kind of iffy, and I don't know if they've got the weather that we had here this afternoon with one rainstorm after another. So I don't know exactly what transpired from the Hamfest in Timonian. But Howard did ask me the other day about operating 6-meter mobile sideband, getting on the sideband 6 meters, and what is a viable antenna, being that I don't think the old-fashioned halo-type antennas are any longer available, Dick. Over.
Okay, it turns out there are a couple of guys in New Jersey, K2UIH, Dr. Alan Katz of Trenton College, and WA2LTM, Doug Moser of Mercer College. These two guys on the 6-meter band talk to each other mobile to mobile every day as they drive to work. And they're using cloverleaf antennas, which I think are homebrew, but I'm not sure. So the cloverleaf horizontally polarized antenna does the job for them very nicely. The closest thing I can tell you about my experience is that for about a 1.5-year period of time, every single weekend, I was traveling from Long Island up to Utica, New York, to go to the Rome Air Development Center for a project that I was involved in. And I was using 2 meters from my mobile, single sideband. I had a 5/8 wave ground plane whip on the top of the station wagon automobile, as well as a M-squared loop antenna for 2 meters. And I had a switch in the passenger compartment where I could flip back and forth between the horizontally polarized loop and the vertically polarized whip. And as you guys have heard me tell so many times, I was talking to some pretty big gun stations, I'll admit. A guy in southern New Jersey on sideband, and a guy in Albany on sideband or on FM. And as I drove along the New York State Thruway, I was holding 200-mile QSOs on 2 meters on sideband. And when I flipped back and forth between the horizontal polarized loop and the vertically polarized whip, while talking to a guy with a pretty big array in far southern New Jersey, which was horizontally polarized, I couldn't hear any difference between the vertical antenna and the horizontal antenna. They had nearly equal gain. Common sense would have led you to believe, hey, you're cross-polarized when you're using the whip, therefore he should hear nothing. He heard me beautifully. Because the signal was, let me drop.
GOT Mobile.
Howard recognized. We'll get over to you in a second. But when that signal went from the New York State Thruway all the way down to southern New Jersey, and I was talking to him all the way up to Utica, where we're transmitting through those mountain ranges of the Catskills and the beginning of the Adirondacks. And how in the world that signal made it, I'll never know. But by the time it bounced through all of those water towers and trees and got sifted by those woods and everything else, there was no real polarization. As I drove along, I would rapidly flip back and forth between the horizontal and the vertical antenna from my mobile, and there was essentially no difference. Only when I get up to a very high scenic overlook did the co-polarized signal show up 10 or 15 dB stronger. But when you've got a heavily multipath environment, the polarization becomes randomized. The bottom line of that is that if a person put a 6-meter whip on his automobile and he operated sideband and talked to horizontally polarized sideband stations from his mobile, I think you're going to find there's only a small number of dB of difference between that and a purely horizontal antenna. But if you want a purely horizontal antenna, homebrewing a Saturn 6 Halo is fairly easy. And these Cloverleaf antennas that Doug and Alan are using, K2UIH, Alan, and Doug W2LTM, seem to be very successful. Howie, you probably want to make comment on all of this. N2GOT, I think it is, K2RIW and TechNet, give a couple seconds to wait.
Can you get to HWW with a question on the subject matter?
Howard recognized, but Howie number two recognized, but Howard number one, GO2 sees first. Go ahead, GOT.
Dick, I'm stationary at this time in the mobile. Am I making the machine okay?
A little bit noisy, but you're making it. Go ahead, Howard.
Dick, I just got home. I was actually playing around with the radio in the mobile. This is one of my new acquisitions. It's an FD8900. I just picked up at Simonian yesterday at the Hamfest, Dick, and I was inquiring at HRO. I spoke to another friend of mine at the Hamfest regarding a 6-meter antenna. And I was about to mention that they had recommended Ham Squared. I'm currently using a Comet UHD-6 antenna, and I've had very poor results. I haven't had any contact on 6 meters with it. But I understand from speaking to a gentleman that worked at HRO, I believe his name is Jim, I might be correct, says that the propagation in the Northeast is very sporadic, pun intended, I guess, 6 meters. Sometimes it works, sometimes it cannot. So you have to be on at the right time. Back to you, Jim. And again, this is a H2FD8900. There's a little bit of a learning curve on this radio for me. Back to you.
Okay, that FT8900 sounds like a nice rig. And when we send it back to you, I'd like to hear a little bit about what the weather was like in Timonium. And a rough guess on your part, was it 2,000 people or 10,000 people? I was once at Timonium when I think there was like 15 or 16,000 people there. Rather big ham fest by my standards. Held at what I think is a racetrack, or is it the Maryland State Fairgrounds, I think it is. A little bit hard to get out of there when the event ends. The local roads are a little bit jammed with traffic. But other than that, a very nice location for a ham fest, for a flea market, or whatever you're going to call it. It turns out that on 2 meters, the horizontally polarized loop antenna I was using was an M squared. And the M squared 2-meter antenna worked like a charm in dry weather. And because that was designed for the California environment, in my opinion, where it's quite dry, when that antenna got wet, it really detuned something terrible. And I tried a number of variations to try to keep the water out of the antenna to stop that effect from happening, and I wasn't successful. Maybe I just didn't hit it right. Hopefully the 6-meter version is going to be different. Now, you've got to be a little bit careful when it comes to what you expect mobile operation versus home operation. In the case of a good home operation, with a, let me pick a number, a 30-foot tower and a Yagi antenna and 100 watts of sideband, boy, you can work the world with a little bit of help from Mother Nature on 6 and 2 meters. When you go down to a very low-gain antenna at a very low altitude from an automobile and you contend with the local ignition static that you might be getting if you don't have the world's best noise blanker, life becomes a little bit more complicated. If you're not talking to a really big gun that's aiming a moon bounce antenna at you, that's what the guy in New Jersey was doing. The guy in southern New Jersey was aiming a moon bounce capable array of 4 Yagis at me. And he was blasting very nicely. So you got to cut back your standards a little bit. The fact that you work nobody, though, is a little bit disappointing. I think you guys from the Kings County Radio Club, where you do these shootouts, there should be a little bit of an experiment from, say, Mel's house over to your mobile as you drive around to the five boroughs, or maybe a little bit further, and find out what kind of
repeater, timeout,
and find out what kind of reception you're getting under those particular environments. So back to you, Howard number one first. What was Timonium like? Give us a couple of words, weather-wise and people-wise. A rough guess, how many were there, and did you get rained upon? N2GOT, K2RIW in the second half.
Okay, Dick, I was just waiting for a parking spot to open up on my house here in Brooklyn. First of all, the weather, I picked up, I was with Tony, WW2W. I met up with some hams in that area, as well as some other hams that came in from the Brooklyn area. We had a great time. And I would say, I would give a guesstimate that maybe there was 10 to 20% of the attendance, maybe 10% of the attendance that you had claimed that you had seen there. I think you said around 16,000. Maybe a couple of thousand, I would imagine, or less than that. I don't have an exact number, but I think the numbers are most certainly down from years past. Dick, there were a lot of several commercial vendors there. There were a lot of very good deals to be had down there. As long as you had a lot of C-notes with you, if you will. Because not everybody took class, which of course. So you had to really know how to sift through the good deals, Dick. This is one of the rigs which was purchased. One of the many transactions that were made that I'm on, and this is a quad bender. It's only FM to transmit. It will, I believe, receive AM, but I don't know. I think that it does. It covers 6, 10, 2 meters, and 70 centimeters. Regarding the weather, we got some phenomenal shots. Frank, WB2BXO, can attest to that as well as Tony, of the front coming in, of the storm coming in. The weather was pretty poor both days, but there was some tailgating on Saturday. The weather did hold up on Saturday. The weather did hold up for the tailgaters on Saturday, even though the system pretty much stayed with the poor weather stayed with us on Saturday and Sunday. Back to you, Constituency.
Okay, I left a nice long delay just in case. Thank you for that report, Howard. And so I guess the combination of the state of the economy, the weather, and whatever, you think it was a lot more like 1,500, 2,000 people. As I said, I've seen numbers like 16,000 where I remember Timonium. Yeah, Timonium has got about five buildings, and I saw the parking lot and the five buildings essentially filled with a combination of vendors and tailgaters. In fact, one of those buildings, they had what I would call is about an acre of indoor tailgating. Very unusual, but you don't even care about the weather. And I guess you're talking now about outdoor tailgating. Yeah, Timonium was one of the really biggies on flea marketing, along with another very large one is Horse Traders in New Hampshire in years past. They also had great big numbers like that of attendance, where in the case of Horse Traders, I have personally witnessed guys flea marketing essentially 24 hours around the clock. They would do it all night long by flashlight. That's enthusiasm. Starting on the Thursday afternoon and going through at least to Sunday morning. And how these guys can do it, I don't know. Okay, yep. Mr. HWW, I think you want to make a comment. Go right ahead, K2RIW.
Same thing, and I will say to N2GOT, if you want to try me on 52525, we can do that later on. I'll bring the remote base up, and I can probably hear with no problem, or 10 meters. But the question is this, that antenna you were talking about on 6 meters, is that like a big wheel, the clover leaf? Is that like the old big wheels that were made back in the early 70s? And I think you're going to get a lot better communications with horizontal, because most of your noise is vertically polarized. So from my experience, I think horizontal is the best way to go mobile to mobile on 6 feet. Dick?
Yeah, to a degree, I guess I got to agree with that, Howie. However, the noise you get that is stronger vertically polarized tends to be impulse-like. And I can tell you that there are noise blankers and there are noise blankers. If you've got an extremely good noise blanker, like the one that's built into the auxiliary blanker you can put into a Drake R4C, and I think some of the Kenwood rigs had a noise blanker that was almost as good. The Kenwood, what the heck was the model number on that? TS-850 or something like that also has a very good noise blanker. I'm wondering if all that noise that's vertically polarized on 6 meters you're talking about, if some of it wouldn't be helped by a good noise blanker. You've probably done quite a bit more recent 6 meter activity than I have. 6 meters was the first VHF band I cut my teeth on in roughly 1959, 1960. And I was big on 6 meters in those days before I moved into the current QTH. I haven't used 6 meters since, although I'm fixing to use it again. I really miss that band. So what's your guess as to how much of the noise do you think would survive vertically polarized if you had a real good noise blanker? Over to you, Howie.
Hi, Diggy.
I'd like to hear what you said, Howie. And so there's various ways we can get the message from you. One of them is you can go to your higher power mode. As soon as you're ready for that, call us back, and we'll get that last statement you just made. I'll throw it over to you right now in case you're able to do that in a short period of time. KQRIW. Quite possibly Howie is reconfiguring to do that. In the meantime, Mel, back to you. Oh, one quick question I've got for you and to GOT. That quad band unit, FT-8900, I heard you say it is FM only. I'd like to believe it's got some sideband capability. Enter GOT, K2RIW.
Dick, I'm running battery power. I don't have my engine on. Am I making a repeater?
You sure are. Please tell us if it's got sideband capability.
A negative, it does not. It does not have single sideband capability. That is a major downside to the radio. It does not have sideband capability. Over.
Okay, I can tell you for a fact that sideband gets rather little use mobile-wise, and that's not the way it should be, in my opinion, because when it comes to real range, if you're not talking to a repeater, sideband has got a hell of a lot more range, mobile-to-mobile, mobile-to-fixed, than does FM. FM is ideal when it comes to talking to a repeater. So, and the modern-day rigs with a good synthesizer, the fact that the automobile is shaking, rattling, and rolling doesn't really matter. The rigs hold on there very nicely. In the early days, when people had variable frequency oscillators that were not frequency synthesized, the vibration of an automobile would make the frequency of the radio hop around as you drove over the bumps, and therefore sideband, where you want to be tuned to the nearest 10 or 20 hertz, was difficult. With modern-day equipment, that problem goes away. So, for about a 1.5 year period of time, I held a lot of very long range sideband QSOs on 2 meters from a mobile. And it was a fun operation. It was about a 4.5 hour drive, and the drive went a hell of a lot faster when I had somebody to talk to, and we were picking each other's brain, if you know what I mean. Okay, Mel, let's see what other questions you've gotten this week. K2 KEY. With a delay, K2RIW.
Just a quick question, rather than a question, comment. I have a 706 Mark II G, which I have used on a single sideband 6 meters. I have used single sideband on 6 meters with no success, but I have not put up an antenna on my my roof yet at home, which I might just do. And I just had a quick question how that would affect channel 2 or any TV channels once we go to HD, but I know Mel is supposed to get it into GOT.
Now, that's a darn good question, Howie, number one, and two, GOT. Digital television, when it really happens, in almost all of the portions of the United States will be abandoning the true channels 2 through 6. The VHF lower channels will be abandoned. So the 54 to 60 megacycle channel that used to be so easily jammed by a 6-meter operator, that problem no longer exists. The real frequency numbers of channel 7 and up are going to be used for digital television. So there's another reason why 6 meters is going to have a resurgence from my point of view. I think that answers your main question. And so since you've got a 706, a good respected rig that's got nice sideband capability, the fact you didn't work anybody, could be you were just on at the wrong time. How many watts do you think you were radiating? How high was the antenna? Do you believe the antenna has a good standing wave ratio? And have you measured the sensitivity of the receiving system? What's your guess as to its noise figure? Were you using a preamp? There's a couple of other variables there. Because of Channel 2 being so popular in metropolitan areas, I'd like to believe that in metro areas, 6-meter handband is getting very light use up until now. But when digital television takes over, I think it's going to have a resurgence. So